Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. Friends, are continuing with the Datu Vibhanga Sutta. Through the investigation or the development of sensitivity to the sense bases and a feeling that arises from contact, and then just the further reflection on the six elements, particularly in terms of not me, not mine, not myself, seeing them as they truly are, as being impermanent and impersonal, and not the ultimate refuge. And in particular, in the contemplation of consciousness itself, seeing the arising of consciousness independence on contact, and the subsiding of the arising and subsiding of the feeling moment by moment based on contact, then this is the basis for developing a profound equanimity, which may be directed towards the sublime and subtle states of meditation within the immaterial attainments. It is a kind of a natural progression for those who have investigated the jhanas, that are within the jhana. There's the arising of very clear blissful experience, the piti and sukha, based on seclusion, and again based on one-pointedness, and that then through the development of jhana, the agitation related to piti and sukha comes to be seen as a burden. And then the mind doesn't want to stay in the blissful state, and gradually subsides towards becoming more and more equanimous, so that then the fourth jhana has a very strong the factor of equanimity is very strong in the fourth jhana. And it's said that within that jhana there's the perfection of mindfulness and equanimity, or you could say the perfection of mindfulness due to equanimity. And so then, with that profound equanimity, one has the possibility of developing the further immaterial meditations. But the Buddha points out the subtle danger in those immaterial meditations, that if one has any clinging to those states, then rather than reaching the ultimate goal, one would go to death with that subtle clinging to that kind of state, and therefore spend many tens of thousands of eons existing in that state. And those states of existence are not, I think, usually considered to be the most fruitful for gaining wisdom. So actually it's within the jhana that there's strong possibility for obtaining insight. There's a discussion in the commentary where, in, I think it's in the Visuddhimagga, it's commented that within the state of jhana, one is not able to do the work of gaining insight. My teacher, Bhante Gunaratana, disputes this commentarial position, and his idea is that actually that because of the statement that especially within samasati, within the fourth jhana, that there's the perfection of sati, the perfection of mindfulness, his idea is that within the jhana, you know exactly what's happening all the time. You really know where you are and what you're experiencing. So it's not that one's going into a blank state or a state of unknowing, but instead that the knowing has become even more powerful. But the perhaps you could say the volitional side has been disabled. I'm not sure if others have noticed that, but it's always seemed to me that the two sides of the mental functioning, the side which is related to cognizing or sort of like receiving experience, and then the side that's related to action and the volitions, that when one is involved in the volitional side of the mental process, it creates a lot of sort of like a background noise or something, so that it's not very easy to be completely clear-minded while one is in the process of building up to a volition. Even they say outside of the Dhamma in psychology that what happens there may be some kind of experience of an unbalanced state that needs a correction. And at the very first instant, it's not experienced with so much intensity. But then through the mental process of coming to a clear perception of what the situation is and putting a name on it, then that perception process is pulling something out from our memories, which will then bring out a whole other a drawer full of feeling. So there's the feeling that you had about the actual thing that's happening in the here and now, then there's a perception, and then there's additional feelings. It's like the memory is put in the same file cabinet with the feelings that were associated when you experienced the same thing before. So then that can strengthen the tone of the pleasant or unpleasant aspect of it. And then if one gets into a proliferation, then there can be a sort of a discursive thinking process where the mind basically is fabricating a story of justification, and the story then itself is arousing even more layers and layers of feeling, and so then it's a kind of a synergy or a symbiotic process that is creating an escalation of feeling until finally the person is sufficiently aroused to take action and to do something, to get up off the seat and take some action. And so that's that process of arousal seems to happen the most strongly when there's a lack of full awareness. But if anywhere in the midst of that cycle of arousal towards action, if very clear awareness comes in, that can have a tendency to put a damper or to cut through this escalation. And so then it's for that reason that it's difficult to obtain our final the liberating insight that we're seeking for while we're in the midst of our activities in daily life, especially if we've got a lifestyle where one is habitually doing a lot of arousal to become emotionally activated or stimulated in order to do whatever it is that we need to do in our daily life, where it's necessary to leave that behind and to come and to sit in a special circumstance like being on the meditation cushion or in the meditation retreat in order to give that a break and to experience this not needing to do anything. Sometimes it happens during a retreat that people remember something that they needed to do. Like, you know, it could happen that maybe there's some, like a relationship that's unresolved, and it can come like very strongly into the mind saying, oh, I really just read a letter to this person and, you know, explain something or express something or, you know, apologize for something or to make peace from a situation that's that was left, you know, in a negative way. And so then during the retreat, the student will be thinking, oh, let me just get a piece of paper and write this letter and send this letter. And it's very suitable within the retreat environment to like recognize and acknowledge and that may be a wholesome intention, a beautiful intention to you know, pacify something that was unpeaceful or to resolve something that was a conflict or that was negative in some way. And but for that, to get the most power from the retreat, we don't recommend to like relieve the pressure or the feeling by taking a break from the retreat to write a letter and put a letter in the mailbox. But instead, the idea is to simply acknowledge, you know, here's this memory and it's unpleasant or uncomfortable, and we can see that forming this different intention has a pleasant aspect, and just to know what it is. But that during the retreat that we're not engaged with doing anything. So I'll read the next paragraph of the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. So regarding the three kinds of feeling, the meditator understands it's impermanent, there's no holding to it, there's no delight in it. When they feel a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling, they feel it, he feels it detached. When he feels a feeling terminating with the body, he understands, I feel a feeling terminating with the body. When he feels a feeling terminating with life, he understands, I feel a feeling terminating with life. He understands, on the dissolution of the body, with the ending of life, all that is felt, not being delighted in, will become cool right here. Then he gives this metaphor. Just as an oil lamp burns in dependence on oil and a wick, and when the oil and wick are used up, if it does not get any more fuel, it's extinguished from lack of fuel. So too, the feelings are experienced in this detached way, that instead of being rolled into a synergy of escalation, where there's a pylon of a series of feelings in the same category that are escalating, instead each feeling moment has its own lifespan and has its own cessation. It's not attached, so there's no grasping, there's no picking up of that feeling. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this wisdom possesses the supreme foundation of wisdom. For this bhikkhu is the supreme noble wisdom, namely the knowledge of the destruction of all suffering. And so this is the first of the adhittana, or the first of the determinations, or the first of the foundations that the Buddha is recommending, is the foundation of truth. His deliverance being founded upon truth is unshakable, for that is false bhikkhu, which has a deceptive nature, and that is true, which has an undeceptive nature, nibbana. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this truth possesses the supreme foundation of truth, for this bhikkhu is the supreme noble truth, namely nibbana, which has an undeceptive nature. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he undertook and accepted acquisitions. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them, so that they are no longer subject to future arising. And that will be the relinquishment, which is the second of the adhittanas that the Buddha recommends. And when we say that we take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, we're taking refuge in the human capacity for awakening, the Buddha, the capacity to experience this transformative truth. And taking refuge in the Dhamma is taking refuge in this truth itself, in the actual fundamental nature of reality when it's seen in this way, which is purified of all kinds of deceptions and distortions. And then the Sangha, the significance of the Sangha is that this awakening when it's accomplished by a Buddha, it's not a unique one-off kind of event that only happens, you know, once in an aeon or once in a very rare while to a person who's got this unique accumulation of the perfections and the circumstances that permit coming into this awakening. But it's also something that through the transmission of the Dhamma is then accessible to a person, to the community of persons who have a chance to hear the Dhamma and undertake a training in a particular way. So there's this promise that awakening is attainable, that one does not have to be a Sammasambuddha, this unique individual who only comes about once in a in an eon or something in order to wake up, but instead the markers are laid down, the pathway is shown, the path of training is shown, and one is able to then undertake the training with the confidence that this training would lead towards awakening, and that this training would not lead in the opposite direction. It would not lead us to perpetuate and strengthening our being trapped in the cycle of samsara. In this way, the fact of causality, which is given in the Four Noble Truths, is like a special case of causation. So there is dukkha, there is the cause of dukkha. There is, when the cause is removed, there's a cessation of dukkha. And there's a way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So there's a way to bring about removing the causes which support the perpetuation of dukkha. And so then it's possible to for dukkha to come to an end. But then, in another way, Nibbana is an opposite to what's called sankhara, or formations. And in a certain way, formations are a conceiving, you could think of it as being a kind of a mental construction which is constantly tending to take us away from the actual experience of reality as it is. So then, if you consider, here's science, and plants and animals have all been classified and named, and it's been become, you know, clear which what is a species, and that, you know, species only can breed, I guess, with their own kind, and there's a certain amount of variation within the species, but it has these fixed characteristics, and any bird that has this set of characteristics is called a robin, and if the robin is related to a group of other similar species, which are called thrushes, and the thrushes are part of some other subset of a subset, and with all of this, construction, this identification of the signs and symbols, of how we make these distinctions, that's useful in a practical way. It's not an evil thing, but it still is something that can be sort of like putting up a barrier to actually having the full direct experience of sitting in the garden and seeing a robin or hearing a robin. So those are like two. That's the danger that we have with the fabrications, and just the same way that the whole other set of fabrications that are related to our goals can get in the way of life. You can see this in a moral sense if you consider how some parents, especially parents who are in a working class situation, have a very strong desire for their children to be successful. And so they want to provide economic security to the family. And so then you can have families where the two parents are working multiple jobs, trying to build up enough wealth so that the children will be able to go to college or get their start in business or to do what seems to be needed for their children to become successful. But because the parents are so busy with earning, and then the children are missing what they really wanted the most, which was to have the presence of the parent, to have the actuality of the parental love expressed in a different way. So then it's like our goals can sometimes get in the way of what's really suitable. There's another example about the truth that something I read in the paper a long time ago, years ago, that seemed very poignant to me. There was a person who was a fraud who was posing as the black sheep son of one of the wealthiest of the American great families, and was stealing money by tricking people into investing with him. So this person had rented an apartment on Fifth Avenue and bought some expensive works of art and to put in the apartment, and I guess gotten a wardrobe and some other things that would be like the accoutrements of a wealthy and a highly cultured accoutrements of the ruling class, and then was using that to trick people. But the thing that seemed poignant to me was that keeping up this charade must have been so so much effort and so much work and so much anxiety that there's like lies and lies and lies and trying to always keep the story straight and not to let anything slip or let anything show. So that then we can see that like carrying a false flag is very stressful. And so many of the labels that we have in a way that we carry as part of our identity are a type of a false flag. So we might think of being a man or being a woman or being when I came here to California, I was very aware of being an Easterner, which is culturally different than the California people. And so, trying to live up to some type of a concept of what we are supposed to be that can be stressful. And one of the metaphors for Nibbana is to put the flag down. So instead of, you know, carrying around this, the weight of this flag of our identity, we just put it down. And then that's the end of that stress. Whatever is done in terms of using concepts and signs as a shortcut to mark out and organize our reality in a way so that we're able to go through life. If one can experience all of those constructions as being very provisional, just something that's being used temporarily, which is kind of a, like the constructions are sort of like a screen in between the person and the actual reality, and somehow or other, with the development of wisdom or the development of truth, that this screen becomes something that becomes like thinner and thinner and more transparent, and something that doesn't need to be insisted on or need to be held on to or something that needs to be kept rigidly, but it's simply something that's being picked up and used for a purpose. But then it's very easy at any moment, if that construction becomes not useful, it can just be put down. There's a way that when one is caught up in the web of circumstances, that a person can be very hemmed in and bound and caught in a sort of like a web of conditions. It would be like if you've purchased a home and you have a mortgage and you have to pay the mortgage and then you have to keep the job, and then there are like things that you need to do to be successful in keeping the job that are maybe not compatible with your highest goal, but you just, you know, sort of have to, and then you have to be you know, concerned, and you don't want to disappoint your boss, and you don't want to disappoint your spouse, and you don't want to disappoint your children, and so you're ending up with being bound with so many commitments and obligations, and the whole life is spent, and you're working, you know, long days. You know, get up in the morning, and you have to take care of your family in the morning, and then you have to go to work and take care of your boss, and then when you come home, maybe there's, you know, more responsibilities that you have with your family, and you have to you know, take your child to some kind of sport activity or theater or something like that, or you know, their musical performances or whatever children are doing, and you've got to be present for that, and then at the same time, in this day and age, people carry their device around with them, and so your boss or your client can be like beeping you even while you're sitting in the auditorium watching your child in a performance, and it's this continuous buildup of stress and exhaustion because of feeling so like hemmed in by contingencies. There's a certain way that the truth is like the knife that cuts through this Gordian knot of cause and effect. And in a certain way, the truth is like the grace that allows you to circumvent all of these conditions. This is manifest or shown in a metaphorical way in a lot of the Jataka stories about the perfection of truth. You know, that perfections or the paramis were developed by the bodhisattva through many lifetimes. And it's the result of having the perfection of truth, of generosity, of wisdom, and so forth, that the bodhisattva finally reached the state of coming into his last birth, where there's the chance for the final awakening. One of the stories about the perfection of truth is the story of the little quail who was not yet able to fly and not yet able to walk, had just been born and just been hatched out, and then when the fire came, the parents flew away, and the quail was trapped in his nest, the baby quail, and his truth was that he spoke to the fire god and said, "Oh, fire god, I'm only this tiny thing, and I'm not able to fly away. By the power of this truth, please stop, O fire." And so based on that true statement, the fire stopped. And so a certain distance away, the fire went all around, but it didn't go close to that tree, and it didn't cause that harm. So this is sort of like a miracle that nature stopped in its course. So what is what we say is nature is it's following its own laws of cause and effect and cause and effect. Or you could compare it to a feud. You know, if somebody kills your relative, and you feel that it's necessary to have justice, and so that then your family would organize to find the perpetrator and kill the perpetrator, but then the perpetrator's family wants justice, and then they would come back at the member of your family and so forth. And that's how dukkha becomes socially perpetuated in an unending cycle. But the Buddha is able to take these kind of disturbances, these feuds, and he just says, stop. Just stop. And with that truth, the parties are able to just stop and lay down their weapon and just give up the feud, just give up their anger. So, in a certain way, when they do that, it's overturning the law of nature. I guess you could say that getting revenge is a law of nature. And it can just be overturned by the power of the truth. Because of impermanence, our situation is continuously deteriorating and falling away from being just the way we want it to be. And we're constantly pushing the boulder up the mountain, trying to again make our external circumstance to become comfortable or to become right. So we have this endless work that endlessly things are falling apart and we're trying to put them back together. They're falling apart and we're trying to put them back together. The truth, when we realize the truth, we can just stop and say, well, we don't have to put them together. It is what it is. We can be perfectly at ease and comfortable with the whole catastrophe. Just knowing that what we're experiencing is the nature of reality, and just being at ease with it, just allowing it. And then, so in that way, when the feeling arises, we don't have to pick it up and make something else to go on through our volition. We don't have to go on. We're able to give up all formations. We can give up all volitions and just allow when a feeling or an experience comes to an end, allow it to come to its end. And so that's how we don't have any inclination to perpetuate our existence, how we realize the nibbana in the sense of being cooled down. So I hope this was clear enough, and that may be enough for tonight.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.